Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
This week on The Wheelhouse. The media. Our impact on the 2024 presidential election. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse. It's a show that connects politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond right here. We're only a month and a half into this year's election cycle. Feels like forever. But it's shaping up to be one for the books. There's artificial intelligence and the threat of disinformation. Lies from one candidate about the last election, the fact that candidate faces 91 criminal charges, and then there's age. Are the candidates too old to be president? Safe to say that we're living through a new frontier in American politics. So how are journalists meeting this moment? Or maybe, how should journalists be meeting this moment? With me today, I have a guest who dedicates much of his time thinking about those questions. So happy and so privileged to have David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR News. Thank you for joining us today, David.
What a pleasure. Happy to do it.
The pleasure is all mine today, sir. Thank you so much for coming on. And if you want to give us a call this hour, it's 888-720-9677. Join the conversation at 888-720-9677. Well, David, I'm glad to be hearing that you're covering this very closely, so people should pay attention to your reporting here at NPR.org. But we've heard the future of our democracy is in doubt as we head into November. Can you expand on that a little bit? What's at stake during this presidential election, and how is this year maybe different from other presidential elections?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that almost every time there's a presidential cycle, you will hear where this is the election that determines the future, or this is, you know, the most fraught election in a generation or more. Obviously, this election is huge. You're seeing a stark difference in two leading candidates. President Biden presumptively will be carrying the standard forward for the Democrats, and former President Donald Trump looks as though he's pretty much going to run the table when it comes to the Republican primaries, although those aren't officially over yet. But these are not just two starkly different figures leading two starkly different parties with different platforms and policies. I think it's very unlikely that the Republicans will have a platform at all, as in fact they have not under during former President Trump's previous venture running a presidential campaign. This really is two starkly different views about what democracy means and how it operates, and its willingness to, at least according to the record we've seen so far, accept the processes and machinery of democracy itself. And so the institutions of American democracy are kind of groaning right now. You see it in Congress in the way it works and often doesn't work under this kind of cognitive dissonance about whether or not we should operate conventionally, but with, you know, changing policies, or whether the machinery itself in some ways needs to be undermined or overthrown. And that's kind of where we're at.
I won't argue that this is the most consequential election of our time, because it may be, but it won't beat the media coverage maybe of the 64 election there, I believe it was, with LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, and I believe it was Barry Goldwater. I'm thinking about Daisy Girl when we're talking about this, that famous...
Yeah, there was there's the implication LBJ's, the Democrats ran ads implying that Barry Goldwater, the Republican senator from Arizona, who was the presidential candidate that year, kind of a sacrificial lamb, that he was going to lead to nuclear war and that atomic bombs would be going off shortly as a result. But, you know, you're pitting these Biden and Trump against each other in a repeat of the 2020 race. And it's, you know, we know from 2016 how consequential electing Donald Trump at that time, a real political neophyte, was to the direction the nation took.
So you mentioned there at the end of your previous answer about, you know, whether this is a conventional situation or if it is time to pretty much change it all and maybe change approaches to how we view American politics. So I want to know, what role do journalists play in this historic moment? Not necessarily what should we be doing, but at least are we maybe a player in this? Do we have a role in what's happening here nationally?
Oh, for sure. I don't think it was the media that led to Biden's election in 2020 or Trump's election in 2016. But I think how the media performs is important to people's ability to carry out their civic duty. I mean, the point is to give people the information they need to enable them to act as citizens and not just consumers of news and political information. It's a difference between content and journalism, right? And I think that the media failed in a number of instances in 2016, really primarily in some ways in the Republican primary process, to equip Republican voters with their understanding of what Trump represented. It turned out they wanted to embrace him, but it was on the terms that he had set without the, shall we say, mediation of the media. And there are people who object to that. But part of the idea is we're not simply, although I love C-SPAN in many ways, we're not simply like C-SPAN in the sense that we're just broadcasting things without any analysis or context. We're supposed to offer people that kind of texture so they're not simply overwhelmed by what people say without any ability to process it or disambiguate it for themselves.
And just kind of a reminder, just to kind of paint a picture of what that landscape was in 2016, some names that maybe we've forgotten about to history now, but Jeb Bush was involved in that process. Marco Rubio, I believe, at some point. Ted Cruz, when this was a wide open Republican field, and maybe early on people thought that maybe Jeb Bush would be a favorite because of the connection to former President George Bush. But you're talking about there that we just didn't give out enough information about the other candidates. And maybe how funny it might be if somebody like a Donald Trump is president. Wouldn't that be entertaining?
Right. I mean, look, I remember sitting in a park in New York City right near my office, and the two top people from BBC World Service were there just, you know, collegially. And they said, what should we watch for? What should happen? I think it must have been the fall of 2015. And I said, look, I think reporters are terrible prognosticators. If we picked horses for you to bet on, you'd lose all your money. I was like, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be somebody like Scott Walker, then the governor of Wisconsin, or Marco Rubio, you know, Republican senator. And, you know, the New York Times spent more time informing Republican voters of credit card inconsistencies and questions of whether he billed some stuff to the Republican state party of Florida when he was the chair of the party that were really for personal use, than they spent looking at Trump's the four bankruptcies of Trump's business enterprises and the ways in which his policies were all over the map. And he had been taken to court repeatedly by creditors over, you know, things about his business record that the New York Times had investigated in the decades previous, but hadn't been collated and re-examined through the prism of this guy wants to lead the nation and is mounting a pretty impressive campaign to do so. They covered him as a spectacle and as sort of this amusing effort from this local New York, tabloid persona. And they covered the rest of them like conventional politicians until it was pretty clear that he was going to run away with that nomination in 2016. 2020, you know, we had a series of crises, many of them self-inflicted by the Trump administration itself, and they were covering his record. And yet this time around, they're presenting it as a president, that is to say Biden, and his challenger, which is to say Trump, as opposed to two presidents, essentially, one current, one former, each of whom have a four-year, almost four-year in Biden's case, administration under their belts, and a record that can be compared side by side, which is really what you have to do at this point. You know, as opposed to them, either one of them, defining what the campaign is by saying stuff out loud that therefore they insist on you doing. Like, yes, cover what they have to say. It's actually important. When Trump says, you know, we're going to tell Russia to go ahead and do what the hell you want to countries that aren't, you know, paying the amount of money as dues toward NATO costs as part of their defense budget, you know, that's significant and that has real repercussions within the NATO alliance and ramifications for Europe. But it's different if we can just say, look, these are substantial records. They have both been president. Let's look at those things and see what course they set for America.
We know now that the 2020 election and January 6th go hand in hand. But obviously, January 6th hadn't happened yet at this point before the election. So could the media talk maybe more about election, potential election interference? I know that's something we don't want to prognosticate, but that's one aspect of the coin there. And then I guess the age question, we talked about it lightly beforehand that both of these candidates would probably be older than Reagan by the end of the next term. I think that was the case at that point, but I don't know if we talked about it at the length that we do now. So could we have maybe discussed the sort of election denying or at least the age question a little bit more last time? Or should it have been right about where it was?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think people raised the age question, but that Biden wasn't showing his age to the same extent then that he is now. There were moments, you know, little stumbles but Trump, you know, I remember Trump walking down the ramp at the White House and reaching for the hand of the then British Prime Minister, Theresa May, I guess reaching for her arm for stability. And it was a thing where he really had trouble with that ramp and people didn't dwell on it. And I'm not sure they should dwell on it too much, but it was a data point, right? But that's all it was. With Biden, it's kind of this meme and this inescapable, absolutely inescapable narrative at this point that anything that he does that shows some sort of fragility, vulnerability, not just mortality, but fallibility feeds into a conclusion that it's senility, you know, and I'm a little humble on this. You know, I've been known to address each of my three daughters by the wrong name until I get to the right one. And at the same time, you know, even acknowledging the fact that Biden was famous for gaffes over the decades, you know, there is something there to think about. And it's not without validity to examine for each of them. And at the same time, you know, I think it's something that has to be done thoughtfully and not, as so often is the case with our political press, done in sort of a pack oppressive occlusion of everything else. You know, it just seems as though we're able to funnel one story at a moment and not able to hold two thoughts in our head at the same time. And that's kind of what I think voting and citizenship and democracy requires, is the ability to handle more than one thought. You know, political professionals would tell you otherwise.
So then I think you kind of dovetailed into there naturally going into this kind of election season and the coverage that we're seeing now. Just a brief look at it, David, I want you to judge all of our colleagues here, if you can, without getting too far into the age component, I guess, because I do want to drill into that a little bit more. But And maybe some of the things happening with Donald Trump as well I want to drill into. But can you just kind of give me a brief kind of, I don't know if it's a letter grade, but just kind of give me an idea of how our fellow media members are covering this election thus far?
You know, I thankfully, my parents were college faculty members, but I've not been in the grading business. Let's put it this way. I think it's lurchy. You know, I think everybody's lurching in this direction and lurching in that direction. There's coverage of the, you know, the strife inside the House, the Republican-led House of Representatives, and questions within the Republican Party over whether or not they even know what they want on immigration and border policy, which they have said is, you know, such an important and vital thing that they impeach the Secretary of Homeland security over it. It's just lurchy. Like, I don't have a real feel for how they're intending to cover Trump exactly. His is really more of a legal story in some ways. He's in so many courtrooms, I believe four criminal trials right now, as well as the aftermath and repercussions of the E. Jean Carroll litigation, first, you know, finding him culpable in a civil case for a kind of sexual assault, and secondly for having defamed her. You know, that it's hard to consider it a convention. It's like, that is the texture of the campaign. He's doing some campaign events, but much less than he's done in years past. And the kinds of he has given more interviews than Biden has, but almost exclusively to what one would consider friendly figures and outfits. And he beats them up, even Fox, when they don't come out the way exactly he wants.
Lurchy. I'm making a note to my EP for the 2025, actually FY26 at this point, or maybe it is FY25. I'm losing my brain here, but maybe to add in a bell or something like that for us, a soundboard, so that when we hear something as magical as lurchy, we could really drive that home for our viewership. I appreciate
I think
that.
Your best bet is to tune into the 2026 Merriam-Webster edition, and that'll no doubt be shoveled picture, in there somehow.
With your picture next to it. I want to play a quick clip here from a CNN town hall that aired last May. You may have heard this before, David. Let's see if you have.
The federal government was seeking them and then had given you a subpoena to return them.
Are you
them.
Ready? Are you ready? Can I talk?
Yeah, what's
you
the mind? Answer?
Can I, do you mind?
I would like for you to answer the question.
Okay, it's very simple to answer.
That's why I asked it.
It's very simple to answer. You're a nasty person, I'll tell you.
Well, that got a lot of coverage, but the town hall itself got a lot of coverage because a lot of journalists said, hey, maybe that's not the proper format to give a Donald Trump town hall. Is that a good way to cover someone like the former president? David, what do you think?
That there's a really big category of people that are someone's like the former president. You know, I think he's a little bit one of a kind. Others aspire to be like that, but nobody's able to quite pull it off. And part of that is that Donald Trump's personality and persona was cemented in the public consciousness, however imperfectly and incorrectly, before he ever announced for office, right? Like, he had about 117% name identity or awareness in the public populace because of his celebrity on, you know, movies and on TV and as a reality show host and all the like. So he can get away with a lot. You know, that clip that we just heard was from a town hall done many months ago, right, by Caitlin Collins, who's one of the new, sort of introducing her to the nation as a new primetime star from CNN, being elevated from morning show host and not much before then being a White House correspondent for CNN. And it was under the ill-fated strategy of Chris Licht. He wanted to engage Trump and Trump sympathetic voters and be sort of bring CNN back from the perception that somehow it was anti-Trump and, you know, had gone over the top. And I think there was some reason to have concerns about that in the public mindset. What they did instead was turn over this town hall, and it was impossible not to be steamrolled. She was set up for failure in a format that's not designed to elicit meaning. It was live. It was stacked with people sympathetic or outright embracing the former president in a live audience. And therefore, the whole mood and vibe of the room was set against her on her own. Excuse me. And, you know, I think that in some ways, the most admirable way of doing it, because Trump really doesn't want his words to be edited, was the way Chris Wallace did. He's now with CNN, but was with Fox News Sunday at the time. And he ran everything Trump said. He didn't edit any of it. But what he did was he did it as a taped interview, long form, and he paused and provided context and correctives to things the president said. And I thought that that was thoughtful. I thought we learned stuff from that. I'm not opposed for Trump being interviewed or being interviewed at length. He's an important and consequential figure in American public life. But I think people should have the right and ability to confront him with his past statements and videotape doing that, and to also provide viewers with context so that it's not just that you're being steamrolled because you're live, because it is really hard. I've talked to Jake Tapper and other anchors about this. When people are interviewing Trump or other folks live, and they're just saying a bunch of things that are untrue, you have to pick and choose what you end up going after. You can't correct everything even everything that's meaningful that's being distorted if they're on a roll. And what Wallace did, I thought, was pretty masterful. That's a format that works. That town hall set up with fans, making CNN sort of, I wouldn't say an arm of the Trump campaign, but certainly in service to what Trump wants to accomplish there, even if it turns hostile, as it did towards the end there, as we heard in that clip that you played, that plays to Trump as well, because he's using the press as a punching bag.
And I appreciate that commentary, because I think about moderating debates as something I've done in the past, and many of my colleagues have had to do, many of your colleagues have had to do, maybe you've done it yourself, but you can't always interrupt these folks, because at the end of the day, our job is to inform the public. And while you want to make sure that you're correcting falsehoods so that people can understand what is the truth and what's not, you also want to make sure that they're not hearing people ramble and argue the whole time, because they might not get anything. So what a delicate and you brought up Jake Tapper, too. The job that they have to do at CNN. Wow. That's incredible in that kind of a situation. I wanted to talk about the coverage of the criminal charges, but I do want to just pivot to the current president here. Some debate over the state of the economy, and it seems like the economy is pretty healthy right now, at least in the fact that we've avoided the recession that we thought we were going to get into it in COVID somewhat, and the stocks, at least with thoughts maybe that the interest rates were going to drop, have at least been up for a little bit. So I don't know. Public opinion says otherwise, though, that things aren't as positive. Why do you think that is? Is the media contributing to this?
Oh, absolutely. I think there was widespread fears that we would plunge into a tough recession, and we didn't. But the media presented it that way. And one of the things you ask, well, is there real world harm? It's hard to know. And it is real hard to know. This is, you know, economics is a social science, which is to say it's squishy. This stuff is not perfectly predictable. But there were a lot of folks who were saying, you know, there could be a soft landing being navigated here after interest rates shot way up. And people really did get affected by that. But you never saw the recession occur. The place the recession really occurred was in the media, where there was a lot of slashing back of ads, initially first in podcasting and then throughout media and digital media. And you saw layoffs. NPR was on the front end of those. We lost 10% of our colleagues to job cuts a little over a year ago. But then you started seeing just sort of marching through newspapers across the country, pretty much everybody except the New York Times. And it was significant and serious. And I think that that's something really that contributed, that the media relentlessly went after the economy and the administration's performance on it. And I think part of that was that there were very valid concerns about the effect inflation was having on particularly people in the middle class and working classes. And secondly, I think it was a way to show that they could be tough on Biden, that tonally the press felt it needed to be able to show that after so many years of controversies and crises and clashes and, you know, just this intense state of combat almost, which was not meant to be adversarial, but, you know, became antagonistic, that it showed it could be offering, you know, an equally skeptical and independent eye on Biden administration, which is important to do. Which, you know, if the press is not doing it, it might as well shut down and go home. But it was doing it on an issue where it turned out the economy ended up performing awfully well. Now, presidents don't get to dictate how the economy performs. They would certainly love to be able to do so. But it does appear that the administration's policies combined with the Federal Reserve policies helped us have a relatively mild treatment, and that unemployment stayed very low after a brief spike. At almost record levels of low unemployment, you know, very good record, particularly for employment of African Americans. You know, these are things that should be celebrated, but you saw it in terms of anxiety, or ultimately late last year stories like, well, things look good. How long can it last? And man, if you're going to predict that things are going to go into the trash heap for over a year, 2 years, and you can't take more than a day to say, my God, it's performing well, then there's something off kilter there. And I think Americans absorbed that, even as many of them, you know, for those who are experiencing the hits that inflation takes, you know, the fact that it's gone down doesn't mean the inflation didn't occur. And we should also remember that inflation hits a vaster number of people than unemployment. You know, if 6% of people are unemployed, that's going to affect them and their families, which is a significant part of the population. But inflation hits almost everybody. It's just that some people won't notice as much because they have so much money.
Last week, Biden's age and questions of his cognitive abilities splashed across the headlines of almost every major outlet. I got the following clip that I'm going to play for you in a second from NPR. Biden addressed it and a report that ignited the latest round of the attacks on the president's fitness for office, a report on the handling of classified documents by a special counsel who said that Biden was a, quote, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory.
There's even reference that I don't remember when my son died. How in the hell dare he raise that? Frankly, when I was asked the question, I thought to myself, it wasn't any of their damn business.
You feel for Biden when you hear that clip, obviously, as any human would be. But the media has been talking about this because, after all, this is our president, so maybe we talk about the age. But is it a problem, the depth that we're covering this, or should this be covered more? I guess, is there a way to cover the age question without being ageist? What's the right way to approach it?
I think that the age and performance and fitness of the president when he's running for re-election is a fair one for coverage and should be covered. I think that similarly applies to the former president who's intending to run against him, whose own behavior was described as erratic and had trouble getting facts right or remembering names or mixing people up, even as recently as the last few days, mixing up Nikki Haley, his potentially primary opponent in the Republican Party for the presidential nomination, and former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, which isn't to say that those concerns are necessarily perfectly equivalent, but I think they're both valid concerns. I think when, you know, a federal official documents those concerns, as the special prosecutor, Robert Hur, did, that it's journalistically valid to explore that. I don't think that's the only finding in his report that's worth reporting. I don't even think that's the primary finding in his report that's worth reporting. If you look at the fullness of what that report said, and I'm not a lawyer, and you know, we have, you know, really accomplished folks at NPR who cover justice issues and the law much more closely than I do. But as I look at that report, you know, it says, among other things, that there are plausible and credible innocent explanations for what Biden was found to have done, and that Biden was fully cooperative, both in terms of the promptness of his replying, his directions to people to cooperate, his sitting down for interviews, and his what it was that he took with him that was analogous in some ways to what other top officials like President Obama or former Vice President Michael Pence took home. In a sense, what he was found to have done was very analogous to Pence. And the special prosecutor said that he did not, you know, while there was some evidence to suggest that he had done so willfully, that is knowingly, which is part of what the statute says must be done for there to be a criminal violation, there equally were credible explanations provided that suggested he did not, and that he didn't have evidence to take that for a prosecution. Well, that's, you know, the rest is kind of commentary, unless what he says on the health is documented to the point that it shows that he's incapable of doing his job as opposed to asserted. So journalistically, I think it's very interesting and important to cover that the president's fitness is drawn into doubt by this report. You know, I also think that the real story is, let's lay together, you know, these two investigations, one of which has led to a criminal prosecution of a former president, the other which said there's not evidence to support one, and lay the record side by side. I mean, they're pretty analogous situations that are actually very different in the documentary record. And so, like, that seems to me to be the larger story, even as I think separately the question of fitness is one to cover too. As I said earlier, can we hold two ideas in our minds at the same time? You know, well, I think the press, we need to be able to do that. Sometimes I'm not sure we convey that to the public.
I appreciate that, because that's a nice segue into what we want to talk about next, which is some solutions. But we're going to take a quick break. Have thoughts on how you want the media to cover the upcoming election? Want to hear from you? Call 888-720-9677.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. A lot of people struggle with sleep apnea and with CPAP machines. Dr. Carl Muller, a head and neck surgeon with Hartford Hospital, describes Inspire, a surgical alternative to the CPAP approach.
Only about 60% of patients can tolerate CPAP real well. Inspire is a surgical alternative to CPAP. It's an outpatient surgery. It takes about 2 hours. And essentially what it does is it picks up when you're taking a breath and sends a 2-second electrical pulse to the tongue, which causes the tongue to stick out a little bit and stiffen and prevent the airway from collapsing.
Hartford Hospital has performed more than 200 Inspire therapy surgeries. If you've tried and failed with CPAP, you could be a candidate for this minimally invasive procedure.
Patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea are candidates. There is a weight criteria, so you have to have a body mass index below 35, and you have to have tried and failed CPAP.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. I've been talking with David Folkenflik, the media correspondent for NPR News, about taking a look in the mirror and asking how journalists can be covering this upcoming election better. But now we're also joined in this conversation by editor-at-large at the 19th and host of a new podcast called The Amendment, Aaron Haynes. Aaron, I just got the subscription. I just subscribed to The Amendment, but I just got a notification that The Amendment, the first episode is ready. Is that true?
That is right. Thank you so much for mentioning The Amendment. The Amendment is officially live today, Valentine's Day, so I am inviting all of you to be my Valentine and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and you can listen to the very first episode, which features Nicole Hannah-Jones. We are in conversation about the role of a healthy press for a healthy democracy, which could not feel more urgent and really more relevant to what we're discussing here today.
Appreciate having you on, and good luck with the launch of the amendment. I just want to ask you briefly, I just had a big conversation with David, who just outlined the issue so well regarding the age of our current president and coverage of our current president, and then, of course, coverage of Donald Trump, not just in 2020, but before before Donald Trump ran for president. Sorry. So can you just give me your two cents here on how the media has covered maybe both of these two human beings who are just titanic names here in America?
Yes, certainly, you know, it is incumbent upon us as a political press to have a conversation about, you know, the fitness of anyone who is running for office. And we know that there are concerns among the American people based on polling about the president's age. He is 81 years old. We know that part of the lack of voter enthusiasm is that not only that we have what is shaping up to be a contest between the same two people that ran for president in 2020, but also that you have, you know, two white men, frankly, in you know, their upper 70s now and early 80s that are on the ballot, the oldest people to ever run for president, who were previously the oldest people to ever run for president. And so that is a topic that is out there for certainly the electorate as we head into November.
Can you help me?
The reality.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, you were continuing. I apologize. I thought you stopped.
No, the reality is that the president is 81. That is, you know, that is something that you know, every day that he wakes up, he is only going to be, you know, a day older, and so his age is not something that is going to change. And so I think that what it is up to us to cover as a press is really that fitness conversation, right? How are the ways in which, if the American people are concerned about his age, how is it that we are able to illustrate that either is or is not an issue, right? Whether that is in reference to President Biden or in reference to former President Donald Trump, who is 77 years old, right? I mean, it's the same generation. So to have that conversation about one of these nominees and not the other it suggests that the American people are not concerned about this as an issue overall, you know, as opposed to just an issue as it pertains to one candidate, even as it may seem that some voters may be more concerned about the current president because he is slightly older.
Just quickly about media literacy, Aaron, what can the media consumers do better to kind of avoid the pitfalls of misinformation? And then journalists, how do we help decipher what's factual and what's not? And AI, how does that kind of complicate this conversation?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I just threw a lot at you. Unpack it if you can for me.
Absolutely. A lot to unpack. Well, listen, I mean, in terms of media literacy, I do feel like, you know, as a profession, we do have an opportunity because you do have a public that is much more engaged in our politics, much more interested in what is happening in this country. And so they are seeking out information, right? And maybe not always in the traditional areas that they have always sought out that information, but they are seeking it out. And what they are finding is not always credible. And it is a lot more sophisticated than when folks like I or David were coming up and it was, you know, Hillary Clinton's alien baby in the supermarket line, you know, in the Inquirer. Right. So, you know, a lot of mis and disinformation can look real. And so, you know, it is incumbent, though, upon our audiences to try to figure out if that information is legitimate. Just a few things that I would recommend to people who are trying to discern that. One, you know, if they are reading a story, if the only place that they're seeing that story is you know, the site or the video that they just watched, if they have not seen this anywhere else, you know, chances are, you know, that report is probably not that original, or if it is that original, it is for a reason, because maybe it was made up, that there's a chance that it was made up, right? So that's one way. You know, really doing a little bit of digging around the internet to find out if something is a reputable you know, source of news, usually can turn up whether that is true or not. And then lastly, I would say, I mean, we as a profession, we absolutely need to be concerned about AI to continue to contribute to the misinformation, disinformation ecosystem, particularly headed into this election. We've already seen, you know, in New Hampshire with the fake robocall that went out, you know, in President Biden's voice likeness that in an attempt to fool some voters, this is something that we're going to have to pay attention to and something that we're going to have to try to combat.
Aaron, I laughed about Hillary Clinton's alien baby in the Inquirer, but when you're a kid and you're in the grocery store and you're seeing constantly, maybe in the year 2000, that we were all going to die in the Inquirer, yeah. Man, that was serious for me back then. So maybe I shouldn't be laughing, because
listen,
if you're seeing that in the grocery store, it can be something. I do want to end the conversation here just by asking David Folkenflik a couple of questions here. David, former President Trump routinely attacked and undermined the press in past presidential elections. Should we expect rhetoric like fake news, enemy of the people this time around?
Well, I would refer you to my statements of some minutes ago, which is to say the reporters make terrible prognosticators, right? But I don't see any reason we shouldn't expect that. I think he's going to build on it. I think that he will, if anything, find ways to be more dismissive, combative. But, you know, he's found new targets, right? It's not just the deep state. It's the permanent, you know, class of, you know, oppressive prosecutors who are coming after him. You know, he's going to find ways to attack the institutions and fold in the press to his attacks on what should we say, on international trade, on the Chinese, on the U.S. Justice Department. He may well fold universities into all this as a number of his those echoing him have done on the state and local levels or school boards. You know, it's part of the establishment that he claims is arrayed against him, even after he, of course, has already won once and has built a following that has ensured that so many in Congress present themselves on the Republican side as accolades of his. But yeah, I would expect him to use the press as a foil, convenient punching bag, even as he can't really live without the oxygen that they help to provide. He draws upon it. He wants it. you know, I think he said something to the effect of, I just want to be loved. He was saying that at one point on Truth Social, I believe last night. And I think he wants that from the press. I mean, I think he has many, many, many decades of his interactions with the press. You know, somebody like Maggie Haberman or Jonathan Swan at the New York Times, who have covered him at times quite critically, you know, he still calls them and talks to them because he wants their attention and the respect of the Times, even as he uses the Times as a target to denigrate and try to tear down.
David, we got just about a minute left here before I say goodbye to you and Aaron. I just want you to help us understand, David, where folks can look for as indicators that a piece is representative of really solid and ethical journalism. Give us an idea of where people should go to. I would imagine NPR and the 19th are places that people could go to.
Yeah, in different ways, absolutely. I think that, you know, places like, particularly if you're looking at the national level, NPR tend to be indispensable. I'd look at more local coverage of local races, of governors, of state lawmakers, and members of Congress. I do think that there are a number of major outlets like the Wall Street Journal's news pages, the New York Times, the Washington Post. But I also would say, you know, if you're basing something on an outrage from a brief clip, try to find something on YouTube or that's an authoritative source that's giving you a much fuller version of what it is. If somebody takes a quote from a letter or a document, see if this is graduate level citizenry here, but see if you can link on the original and read at least a page around it to make sure that the context people are providing for you is correct and is consistent with what the facts show. Because so much of the time, so much of what we're shown is heat rather than light. And I think it's important for us to make sure that what we're being presented is full and real, because even major news outlets have had to backtrack an awful lot.
David, you gave me a lot of time today, and I appreciate that. It was so valuable. Thank you for coming on. I appreciate it very much.
You bet. Thank you.
Catch David's work on NPR. And then, of course, Aaron Haynes. Aaron, good luck with the launch of the 19th, the amendment. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, we're talking to Jaden Edison, justice reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Jaden's going to give us an update on the recent state police ticketing scandal here in Connecticut. Have a question for Jaden? Join the conversation, 888-720-9677, 888-720-WNPR.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
If you've never donated to this station before, that's okay. Public radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days. And thanks.
Give now at ctpublic.org/donate.
This is The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. Thank you for listening this morning. Governor Ned Lamont has proposed that law enforcement face felony charges if they falsify traffic tickets. For more, we're joined by Connecticut Mirror justice reporter Jaden Edison. Good morning, Jaden.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for waiting throughout that last conversation to give us this important update. You gave us a little bit last week, but now we have some news with the state of Connecticut after they recently hired a former U.S. attorney to investigate data from tens of thousands of traffic stops flagged by a local task force. There is some news in terms of a new bill that's proposed. But first, I want to say the group, the Connecticut Racial Profiling Prohibition Project, they fight racial profiling. The concern that they had when they audited some of this information before the independent investigation, or so-called independent investigation, did, they had information for some 26,000 stops that they were likely inaccurate or outright false, rendering the data unreliable. Jaden, can you remind us of what Deidre Daly found in her investigation of that audit?
Yeah, so I think, you know, one of the bigger parts of the audit was that it essentially corroborated the larger problem with systemic failures by the state police to keep track and to make sure that, you know, it's, you know, the agency itself and state police troopers and constables are abiding by the Alvin Penn Racial Profiling Prohibition Act. Particularly, it pointed out failures to respond effectively to initial investigations dating back to 2018 that found that four troopers had falsified ticketing data, which was something that was uncovered by Hearst in Connecticut, who did a great job following that along the way, but also failing to address information that pointed to broader problems with the data and not properly supervising and training the troopers on data entry. So you found these kind of larger systemic failures as it pertains to the racial profiling law. But also what it did find was that perhaps the intentional falsification by individual troopers and constables may have been, quote, far more limited than what was initially expected. But nonetheless, it found that at least six active troopers and one active constable may have intentionally falsified data, and also concluded that internal affairs of the state police obviously should conduct investigations into those officers. But also there were a number of retired troopers who the auditors were not able to, you know, do thorough investigations on due to their retired status. Now, on the flip side, I think what you found was that the auditors did not do any kind of extensive or exhaustive digging into troopers who may have, you know, basically disregarded the state's racial profiling law by not reporting, you know, traffic data into the racial profiling system as required by law. So a number of things going on there, but that's the gist of kind of what the auditors found and kind of led us to this point where we are now.
John Henry Smith, host of All Things Considered here at Connecticut Public, spoke to the person that led the Racial Profiling Prohibition Project's audit of the traffic stop data. He is Ken Barone.
In our report, we had actually identified 110,000 unreliable records submitted by the state police, 38,000 records that had more than seven errors in them in the individual records, 52,000 records that were duplicated to make one stop look like two, three, or four stops, and then the 26,000 uncorroborated stops. So we're really focused on this sort of one action, but the truth, I think, is if we step back for a minute, what we see is a general failure, I think, for the course of many years on the part of the state police.
Will you react to Barone's comments there, Jaded, at least with some reaction to Daly's report that doesn't potentially let the police off the hook here?
Yeah, I think one thing that Ken and a lot of the auditors, you know, along the way always kind of pointed out is that, you know, the audit itself was not a criminal investigation. But what it was concern by the auditors that, hey, this data that we have been collecting for what, more than a decade at this point, and that we have used to pass along to lawmakers who craft public policy, and for people of the general public who form opinions and perspectives and provide public testimony based on this data that has been collected, there were concerns that, at least by what the auditors found, was that here's a problem. Here's what we think may be the particular issues. Now it's up to the state to figure out exactly what the problem is and to solve it. And I think that when you think of it through that lens, rather than thinking of the audit as itself as a criminal investigation, I think it provides the perspective of, you know, you look at the systemic failures by the state police to abide by the Racial Profiling Act. I think that the audit itself corroborates those findings, right? And I think what maybe gets lost in the public conversation is that, again, when you look at this law that has been on the books for more than two decades, but obviously, you know, you had the update to the law in 2012, which created the prohibition, you know, project, which, you know, Ken Barone is, you know, plays an integral part in. A lot of that data and a lot of the information, you know, that, again, folks have used to form kind of public opinion and public policy has largely been unreliable due to the failures outlined in Attorney Daly's report.
Jaden, can you just spend the last minute or so here talking about what the governor and local lawmakers are prepared to do about this, if anything?
Yeah, so the governor has proposed a bill that would criminalize, you know, a lot of the activity that was uncovered by the audit, which would including, you know, police officers intentionally making false written statements or entering false information or data into the law enforcement record. Particularly what it does, though, is it would, you know, define those actions as a Class D felony under law, which is under the current penal code, right, is up to $5,000 fine in a term that wouldn't exceed more than 5 years. I think what's also interesting, though, is that it also outline sets kind of parameters around when, you know, state police need to report this activity to the appropriate authorities. And so what that includes is that requiring the state police to, you know, report any potential violations of that law to the Police Officer Standards and Training Council, which obviously has the authority to launch the decertification process, but also requires the state police to refer any of that, you know, any of those findings to the chief state's attorney so the Division of Criminal Justice can conduct its own criminal investigation. So a lot there. I think there will be a lot of conversation. I think the governor's bill as proposed will evolve through the course of the legislative process, but certainly a foundation and a starting point for the conversation to be had.
And we'll be following it along with Jaden Edison, justice reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Go to ctmirror.org for more information there. We appreciate you continuing to showcase this story on the Wheelhouse. Thank you for coming back, Jaden. Hey, before we go, I just want to make sure we didn't minimize something here. We want to take a second to make a quick clarification regarding an earlier part of the show. A jury did find former President Donald Trump liable for the sexual abuse of Jean Carroll in 1996. Thank you for joining us today, everyone. Today's show produced by Chloe Wynn, technical producer Dylan Reyes. Thanks to Meg Dalton and, of course, Katie Pellico for helping us out. Download The Wheelhouse anytime on your favorite podcast.